And we now move on to Brandon Hamber, who's from the Southern Hemisphere, which is quite close to New Zealand.
I still want an island to win.
Yeah, right. But Professor Brandon Hamber is a director of the International Conflict Research Institute, INCOR, an associate site of the United Nations University, based at the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland. He's also a Mellon Distinguished Visiting Scholar in the School of Human and Community Development and the African Centre for Migration and Society at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg in South Africa. You're also chair of Healing Through Remembering for a period. Well, you were. And so has a lot of experience, both from South Africa and also from working in Northern Ireland. So, Brandon.
Well, thanks very much. Is this on? Yeah. So thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me. I'll make a couple of comments to start, and I thought maybe Robin or Adrian over there might be able to help me, but I couldn't remember who said this, but there was one of the Israeli politicians during the discussions there about trying to resolve the peace process, and was asked, is there any light at the end of the tunnel? And he said, there's light at the end of the tunnel. The big problem at the moment is we don't have a tunnel. And to some degree, I wanted to use that to talk a little bit about the dealing with the Haas component of the Haas process. So I'm not going to talk about flags and emblems and other issues. And really ask the question, why don't we have a tunnel? So instead of sort of saying, what's at the end of the tunnel, ask, why don't we have a tunnel, and see if there's some way that we can jointly try and address that. Incidentally, I do think I know what's at the end of the tunnel, and I think that it's fairly clear, and you can disagree with me, that some sort of centralized mechanism for putting a whole lot of different processes together is going to be needed to manage the past. Not to deal with it, not to put it to rest, but to maybe move it to the next level. It's what Eames Bradley came up with. The organization that I've been involved with, Healing Through Remembering, have routinely said that. The recent Amnesty International report has said that. I don't see any other option other than some sort of centralized mechanism. Now, we can debate what that might look like, but I think that's the light. So the question is, why don't we have the tunnel? Why can't we sort this out? Now, obviously, there are many reasons for that. Some of that's about hurt. It's about the extreme damage that different individuals did to each other. And it's also about the fact that we are scared of having our own perceptions challenged through these sorts of processes. And during the South African Truth Commission, I'll just quote from this. Academical Graham Hayes wrote the following. He said, "The resistances come from many quarters. The perpetrators fear the truth because of the guilt of their actions. The benefactors fear the truth because of the silence of their complicity. Some victims fear the truth because of the apprehension of forgetting. And others fear the truth because it's too painful to bear." And I think that that is as true for South Africa as it is for many other societies. And it is sort of slightly bizarre because I'm actually going to mention ostriches. So I don't really know how that happened. But, you know, in the last while I've been sort of thinking, what are the different ways that people are coming at this debate? And to me there seems to be sort of five ways, and I'm going to present them really glibly just to get the discussion going. And the first of those is the ostrich. The ostrich is, put our head in the sand, if we wait long enough, this will go away. And you hear that being said. The second is the pragmatist, and that was Larkin's comment. We've got to deal with this. Nothing's going to happen. It's draw a line. It's a pragmatic approach. The third I call the high horse rider, and that's the sort of, this is a principled issue. There will be truth, there will be justice, and no matter what, we will stick to those sorts of principles, even if they're unrealistic. The fourth is the deflectionist, or the wishful thinker, which is, if we just get more counselling and support for victims, if we just build the economy, this sort of stuff will somehow go away. And then the fifth for me is the blamer, and this is probably the most dominant person. So the blamer is basically, it's all your fault, you'll never tell the truth, so why should I ever engage in this type of a dealing with the past process? Now, I think the problem is that actually the reality of where we've got to get is somewhere in between all of those things, which I would sort of call the messy, honest realist. And that means that we have to somewhere learn to live with the pain that we've happened, come up with some sort of approach to deal with this that isn't going to be perfect, and it's going to take a long time to sort it out. The problem with doing that is that basically you need some level of compromise to get to that place. You need some sort of proper negotiation. You need some sort of spirit of generosity. And you need a modicum of reconciliation. So the misperception, for example, about South Africa is, oh, the Truth Commission was about reconciliation. Well, actually, to get there had to be some basic level of trust to actually
get to that solution. And for me, I think our interests need to be on that issue. And what worries me about the Haas process is that if we get really fixated on what he's going to recommend, we're not going to build the tunnel. And we have to be thinking about what is that process. Now, there are two major problems with that process. The first is that the very people that we're looking to guide that process are invested in some of those denials that I spoke about. So they don't want to engage in that because it throws open their interpretation of the conflict, whether it's about complicity or damage or harm. So the very people, it's like turkeys voting for Christmas, they're the people who we have to rely on to come up with the tunnel, but those are the same people who have the most to lose by actually constructing that tunnel. Now, interestingly, on the positive side, that's not too different to the negotiation process in and of itself. So the question is, how do we somehow support and give trust and faith so that that can happen? And I think one of the challenges at the moment is there's not a lot of faith that that actually will happen. And that's partly linked to how the last 10 years have unfolded itself, where there's this general perception that things have been getting carved up and people aren't really addressing the problems. And I think there's that same anxiety, even if we get people around the table to construct the tunnel, that we're not going to come out with the type of way forward that we possibly need. The challenge is that I think we have to trust that process and we have to find a way to influence that process. I'm not sure exactly how to do that. The second, and I'll end on this challenge, is that even if we find the tunnel on this issue, we have to be careful that we're still not missing the underlying issues. The fact that segregation exists, the fact that schools are still segregated, the fact that and housing is segregated, all those sorts of underlying segregation issues. So we could come up with a great tunnel, and the problem is, if we're still not addressing some of the underlying issues, we'll be back at the same place about something else in 10 years' time. And just to end, before I left home, in relation to the second point about the underlying challenges, I'd sort of sent out a tweet saying, I'm talking at this, and someone came straight back to me and said, I want you to say something. And what was really interesting, I presume it's coming from Victor's perspective, they said to me, the problem is at the moment is that what people are proposing to us is we just need to live with pills in poverty. And I thought it was such a strong, strong statement and really just underlines the importance of trying to find that direction through the tunnel. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Brandon. And finally, Maureen Hetherington. And Maureen's community relations and peace-building practitioner from Derry, from Londonderry, and has worked in the field of peace-building for 20 years. She's a director of The Junction, a community relations and peace-building initiative, and focuses on issues of ongoing concern that are barriers to peace. And currently they're heading up three major projects, which are Towards Understanding and Healing, and Dealing with the Past through Storytelling and Positive Encounter Dialogue, Ethical and Shared Remembering, Commemoration of in a New Contract, 1912 to 22, dealing with the distant past in a way that allows us to interrogate our more recent and violent conflict. And finally, City of Sanctuary, an initiative that is about engaging all statutory bodies, agencies and sectors to commit practically to building a shared and rights-respecting society that welcomes us all. So Maureen, thank you very much for making the trip down and look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here and also very nervous. We were talking about the Haas, the Sullivan talks, and I brought a little bit of what our submission was, and that was, you know, consulting with community relations practitioners and community development workers and activists on the ground and getting their feedback in order to inform our submission. So just want to set the context about, you know, the Good Friday Agreement that was signed 15 years ago, and it was a shared political arrangement. And it was the best that could be done at that time because we needed a political construct. And it was appropriate at the time, but now the wheels are coming off as a model for a sustainable peace and future. Within that time, there was a legal framework, and that was for dealing with the past, and that was our shared future document. And it was a comprehensive document which was binned by both DUP and Sinn Féin. The shared future document would have enabled the Assembly to deal with those issues that Haas is now being called in to deal with. So for us, the people on the ground who are trying to bring about change are increasingly voicing the opinion that the political process has failed. They speak of a sharing out between Sinn Féin and DUP rather than a sharing for the common good. They observe that in the absence of an alternative, the electorate in Northern Ireland vote sectarian. And these are just some of the issues that we see are problematic. So we see that there's an urgent need to listen to those people and to the grassroots. We feel that there isn't a democracy, that we have a Sinn Féin and DUP carve-up, and that we need to work at the democratic structures which are fair and equitable. So Ambassador Richard Haass has been called in to deal with issues that were the fundamental tasks given to the politicians to sort out 15 years ago. Number one, that's the long-standing sectarian narrative that finds visible expression in flags, emblems, marches and protests. And it's compounded by the failure to deal effectively with the more immediate past, as a result of which the sectarian narrative has been massively reinforced. So that was a task given to the politicians 15 years ago on the basis that solving these problems was basic to addressing the normal, social and economic issues we face. And we saw that after the Shared Future document was banned, we had other documents that followed that, and at the moment we've got TBUC, as some people would refer to it now. And it pales in comparison to the original document, and it's weaker and it's very inadequate. So the fact that Ambassador Haass has had to be called in is the clearest evidence needed that the political system and the power sharing has failed. It may have been the best available in the immediate aftermath of the conflict, but as Duncan Morrow said, who was the former chief executive of the Community Relations Council, it was that the system, it embedded and institutionalised sectarianism. So I think that that's one of the big basic issues that we live with today. So flags, emblems, parades, protests and dealing with the past, they are problematic. But the core problem is the absence of a politics that is capable of dealing with such matters. So the best outcome of the ambassador's process might be that this core problem gets to be named. But as for what might be an alternative politic, the search for same has to begin in public conversation with grassroots, with people working on the ground.
So. Okay, Maureen, thank you very much.
And thanks to the panel.
I hope their comments have been stimulating and challenging, and I think what we want to do is interact with you to get this discussion going and try and look at all the issues. And I think we'll just let any topic that you want to raise it, or any comment that you want to make, if you do that, and we'll just work our way through it and we'll try and balance it as it moves through. And if there's somebody specifically you want to ask a question of, then if you could say that. But if you could stand up and state your name and a comment or a question. So who would like to be first?
A second. Myself?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
No.
One? What's the name?
Yeah.
Brian O'Neill. On a positive note, the increase in marches might help us deal with the obesity time bomb that awaits us all. But just a few small things, because we were we had a meal last week, and we're talking with a local restaurateur in the Dublin Road, and he said last Christmas, this is one small family restaurant, last Christmas he lost £100,000. He'd been trading for 25 years in Belfast, and he said it nearly put him to a wall, basically. That's like one example. Another guy from Donegal, who you're talking to, his father went to a concert last year in the waterfront, first time in Belfast, coincided with a flag protest. He spent 3 days scared in his hotel room. We went to a conference about conferences in Belfast, had a big boom for the council, and they were very happy that they'd gotten over 200 million in revenue in conventions in the past 15 years, which coincidentally is the same amount of money they've lost through the flag protests. So my point basically is that when you consider the scale of damage it is doing to our economy, reputation, tourism, everything else, I mean, it's utterly shameful that our so-called government hasn't locked themselves in a room to sort this out. It's absolutely terrible. And to think a year later, we're just going to have a repeat of it all with this Saturday, one of the busiest shopping days of the year, is going to be a ghost town. And the only people that are going to win is Amazon and eBay, as far as I can see.
Thanks very much. Maureen, do you want to maybe make a few comments in relation to that. Like Derry, Stroke Londonderry has sorted its issues out to some extent.
Yeah,
we've had
a very, very different experience, obviously, in the City of Culture year. It's been an amazing year with great generosity. Things have happened, and we have worked with a lot of victims who have started to reach out now as a result of the generosity of all the people involved. So I think that whenever you say that, it's tragic, and it's a shame that we've come to this point in certain areas with regards to the economy, the bread and butter issues, and then the fear that the politicians will not come to a resolution and a lot of money will be returned. I mean, there's an ongoing debate at the moment. I suppose with us, we're very, very fortunate that we had the opportunity of the City of Culture to start to show ourselves in a new light, to almost change the story we tell ourselves. And that has been hugely beneficial to all sides of the community. Now, we have a very small Protestant minority and a large nationalist Republican community, but it has taken years and years of building trust and ongoing conversations. And I want to throw in some of the stuff. You know, we're currently working with young loyalists, and when we talk to them about, you know, some of them had been protesting, and, you know, they have an interest in knowing, wanting to know more about who they are, where they've come from, and about their history. And when we asked about bringing in people from the other community, they said, absolutely, we need to hear more than our own story. So for me, that was a sign of hope. That was a sign of the future. And these are young people. So we've had a very, very different experience, which has been helped by the City of Culture year. So I don't know if you can get that. I mean, you know.
So what you're saying is, you should go just to Derry for shopping?
Absolutely. You should do.
Leslie, you're in tune with North Belfast and some of the issues that have, you know, they're faced up there. You know, and it's not simply about the number of parades, it's about parades in certain areas and a right of person to exist in those certain areas in an area that is very divided. Like, you've heard the comments, you know, what's your view?
I mean, just like Brian, utterly frustrated, and Peter has set out some of the realities for us. So the question for me is, why are people buying a lie? And who is assisting them to buy the lie? And maybe more importantly than that, who is helping to show the truth? So there are a whole lot of people. It's very easy, I think, to blame the politicians, and I would be, you know, pretty near the beginning of the queue sometimes. But it's also important that the rest of us, I think, recognise that we haven't done so much to kind of force a new debate upon them. So, I mean, I'm from the church, hands up. We haven't exactly been in the vanguard of saying to our politicians, you need to deal with this. We see the lie here, and we want you to speak the truth. We haven't been too hot on that. So I would want to say that first. The other thing, as far as North Belfast is concerned, I mean, it's so critically divided at the minute that it's dangerous. The loyalists are set against each other and intent on being further set against each other, probably. For me, in the middle of them and listening to them and going between them and all of that, it begins to feel like, well, flags are just an appropriate cover for them to keep on going with the things that they want to keep on going with, which are about territory and are about power and about who owns people. And so there are members of what used to be the UDA and members of what used to be the UVF, and they're transferring those members around and expelling them from one organisation and taking them into another, and then rowing about who they belong to, for example. There's the whole drugs issue and how they're connected into that. Serious amount of money laundering going on, and money lending going on, so that people who are already far from the centre of power in terms of how they feel get further and further away from that and become then more open to the lie that they are nothing in this society when they needn't necessarily be nothing. So I think it's very dangerous.
Thanks. Okay, next question. Yep.
Alan Leonard. I'm glad we've got voices from Derry, Londonderry here to talk about the difference between, say, the Northwest and here in Belfast, because in my working experience going back and forth between the two cities and learning about how each deals with some of these issues, I've been most impressed with how Derry, London, Derry and the decades it's taken to get to this point. And so what I would like to hear more from the panelists, particularly Peter, if you've got knowledge about this, is one thing that seems to be a key ingredient in the Northwest is the relationship between the lodges and the bands, where there's good leadership by the Orange in regards to which bands they engage and to represent. Whereas my impression, because I'm not in the Orange, is that here in Belfast and the surrounds, is that the orders and lodges behave in a completely different way, where they will engage with the bands in a provocative manner, you know, versus one where, you know, where the tail's wagging the dog. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about this and what further lessons we can learn from the Northwest, and because I appreciate the differences, but there must be something in the experience of the Maiden City for us.
Peter, do you want to respond to
that? Yes, this links into parts of the previous question as well. I think it's not just up in the Northwest and in Derry. I'm going to say Derry because that's what I naturally call it, but I do mean Derry, Londonderry, but forgive me for just saying Derry. Because I think there has been huge progress there. But there has been progress in other places too, and it's part of the frustrations in our position is that we can't really talk about those, because once you start to talk about and make public some of the progress elsewhere, then it invites people to try to undermine that. But I could point to 6, 7, or 8 different towns or villages where there has been some significant progress. It's not rocket science, and I'm sure Maureen and certainly other people in Derry who have been involved in these processes will also tell you it's not rocket science. Where progress happens on parades, it depends on are people motivated to make that progress? Do they want to do it, knowing that that's going to lead them into a lot of contact and communication with others, and where they're going to have to, on both sides, make some sort of compromise? Is the motivation there? Secondly, have they developed relationships? Because those relationships will lead to a greater understanding and the trust that is necessary to make those compromises. And in Derry, over many years, and it's taken a number of years, those relationships have developed. And part of that is, thirdly, then linked into, is there the leadership there to do this? And in Derry, there is political leadership from across the community divide. There is a leadership from the business community and churches and other civic leaders as well. So when you get that combination of things, if people want to do it, they are willing to develop relationships and the trust, and that they're able to demonstrate the leadership with capacity to deliver, then you get the result. And that's what has happened in Derry. People from Derry will say, as they have to me, this isn't about a model. This isn't a Derry model. This is common sense. And it is. And that might look a slightly different. It might look slightly differently in different areas depending on the nature and the context of those areas. But basically, it's, do people want to do this? Are they willing to invest in relationships? And do they demonstrate leadership? And are they supported by others behind them who are prepared to stand up and be counted and watch the back of those people who are willing to do the deal? In parts of Belfast, one or more of those combinations don't exist, or they don't exist in sufficient numbers or quality or whatever. And that's when you get a breakdown. North Belfast, I agree with everything Leslie says. I think it's a complex situation. It's a dangerous situation. It's complex. I thought a year and a half ago, the Commission has facilitated dialogue in North Belfast for over 10 years, spent £100,000 employing mediators. The dialogue happened. It didn't reach an outcome. And a year and a half ago or so, the Commission said, look, we need to approach this in a slightly different way. And we asked Lord Alderdice, as well as Reverend Norman Hamilton, as well as Father Gary Donaghan, two ministers from the area, to facilitate a more negotiation rather than a mediation. And for a time in June 2012, I thought agreement was close. I mean, when you get the feedback and you realise the offer and the counter-offer that was made, and I was really disappointed. And when I finish doing this job in a few weeks' time, that'll be one of the disappointments I'll carry with me, is that they couldn't do the deal. And I wonder sometimes if the motivation and the leadership was different, including those people in civic society and political leadership who should have been watching the backs of the people to do the deal. If that had been better, maybe we would have been talking of a different situation now. But the situation is as it is, and you have to continue to try that dialogue. Now, unfortunately, since June 2012 to now, we haven't been able to restart the dialogue because one side said, yes, let's do it. The other side didn't even say no. They just didn't even actually come back to us to say whether there was any interest or not. And so you have the situation there now. But there are positives around where it is now. I think it is in a different place. And I think one can see how progress could still be made, but it is still a dangerous situation. In terms of flags, if I can just briefly comment on it. We all know what happened last year. It is worth saying, although I don't want to sound defensive, but protests, as in the flags protest, did not come before the commission. It's not an issue for the commission. The Parades Commission deals with parades and protests related to parades. So the flags protests were not an issue for us. But the legislation within public order is clear. It is against the law to block roads. And you have to understand why people are doing that. I think people have a sense of loss, and that gets us into very deep questions that we're here to talk about tonight. But the actual legislation is clear, and the public order situation is clear. On the 30th of November coming up, the commission on that parade has asked us to leave the City Hall by 12:30 from the city centre, because traders tell us after that is the busiest time, and they want that precedent set, I suppose, of parades happening, but being clear of the city by midday or so, and that then becomes an enforcement issue for the police.
Okay. Sorry. No. Thanks very much for that. Dominic and Brandon, maybe just make a comment. In Derry or Londonderry, you know, one of the benefits they have is they have a huge river and they have a deeply divided city with a huge river between the people, whereas in North Belfast and the other areas around Northern Ireland, they don't have that huge river. And these issues like flags and parades are used quite often to maintain and promote division, or they help compound the problems. And one of the things maybe at the flags highlighted was not so much the flag coming down in Belfast City to designated days, but the fact that the Union flag wasn't flown in a number of councils around Northern Ireland. And what that tends to create, both if a flag is flown in an offensive way or a way of marking out territory, is it creates a chill factor in one way. Or if it's not flown at all, it creates a chill factor in another way. So what do you
think? I have a couple of things to say on that. Firstly, about the so-called Derry model. It is a very different place, and one of the things that people need to realise is the Apprentice Boys are actually a very different structured sort of organisation to the Orange Order. I know they often look the same and people use them in the same breath, but the way that the Apprentice Boys organise centrally in Derry, where the historic city is very important to them, means the decision-making process around some of these things within the Apprentice Boys works in quite a different way to the Orange Order, with a Grand Lodge much more loosely connected to other lodges. So one of the reasons, I think, is the structure of the organisations. But I think you make a very interesting point about the flag. And if I were a unionist, I would be asking if the decision made in Belfast was good for Belfast, then could it be good for Newry and Derry? I think it's a reasonable question to ask. I think it's the logical question that comes after the decision of Belfast, saying if we are finding ways of recognising people's identity, then, and it's interesting to me that unionists and loyalists seem to worry about Belfast more than they seem to worry about Derry or Newry, and I know it's a can of worms, and I know those councils wouldn't thank me for it, all right, but they wouldn't thank me for it, but it is not an unreasonable question to ask the political parties. If you voted for that in Belfast, is it not good for those other places? And I think one of the solutions we could look at around the flag is the way that we represent the particular identities when it's important to represent them. And I think, I think the decision in Belfast was an utterly reasonable and obvious one, but I think it raises questions about how unionism is sometimes represented in those other cities. And I say that knowing And I'll say that, knowing both Newry Council and Derry Council have done some very good things, I really recognise that. But I think that's an interesting... I'll be interested to see if something like that rises its head in these negotiations.